Om Shanti. So I would like to take up the question of self-deception. In other words, being truthful with the self, honest with the self. And a book message this morning, the Baba standing under the rainbow, with all of his aspects in fullness. That is the balance of all the virtues, a full spectrum of all qualities and virtues. And the definition of God in many descriptions that you find is truth. And God is truth. Baba is completely without any body consciousness. And the very famous last words of Baba, Brahma Baba, as he became Avyakt, egoless, bodiless, viceless, is, in other words, truthfulness. So, I'm collecting up a few points from Dadi Janki's class yesterday. For example, she said that you cannot look at a person in terms of their behavior, because that would be untruthful. Like, part of self-deception is to think, I did some stupid action, therefore I am stupid. Or somebody else did some stupid action, therefore they are stupid. Or violent, or whatever the thing is, you know. And so that's the first level, in a sense, the most commonplace level of deception. Self-deception is to see a person in terms of their behavior, or to see the self in terms of one's behavior. And when we see oneself in terms of one's behavior, it's not a rigorous act of self-evaluation, but rather it is, if I don't get an opportunity to do something interesting, which everybody thinks is marvelous and wonderful and fantastic, that means I'm useless, you know. And that is also self-deception. So the key, very good key, which Dadi had reminded us of, is that we can do nothing, but Baba gets done whatever he has to get done through whomever he chooses to get it done through, and which is his own arrangements, which is nothing to do with us. You know? One of the first levels of untruthfulness is to make comments about God that he should or shouldn't be doing what he is or isn't doing. You know? And it's very much part of bhakti to praise God until something happens and then say something about God which is not complimentary. Like, how could he allow such and such to happen? It's a very common phrase, isn't it? You know, and so Baba has given us the knowledge of himself, that I am the truth, and I know the truth, and everything happens because it's in the drama. And this is the one piece of gyan which nobody knows except VKs. Whatever happens, happens because it happened 5,000 years ago. And then we want to think it's good or it's bad, you see. This is good, this is bad. This one's good, this one's bad. So the knowledge of the drama is a very, very powerful instrument to prise us away from our habits. They're not personal habits. These are cultural habits. These are sort of human habits, habits that all human beings have got into, so that it's not our personal thing that, oh, I did it all by myself, I thought it all by myself. Very few people actually think, you know, but we kind of go along with whatever everybody else is doing. And so we are extremely strongly influenced by what is called the false world. So if we say this one's good, this one's bad, partly it's because we've been taught to do that. We've been trained from birth, do this, do that. You are good, you are bad. If you do this, you are good. If you do that, you are bad. You see, all of that is untrue. We didn't know. The people who taught us didn't know. They were taught by whoever taught them. And so it's generation upon generation under the influence of what we can loosely call bhakti, or the ideological approach of materialism, in its quest for truth, ends up extrapolating and arrives at false conclusions. Like, for example, Baba told in the Murli today that people may have a vision of the soul, but they don't have any knowledge of it. Whereas BKs may have a vision of the soul, and whatever you have a vision of, you have knowledge of it. That's very significant, because it means that we can interpret everything not on the basis of extrapolation. You know what I mean by extrapolation? You just say, well, you know, 2 and 2 make 65. That's extrapolation. You put it together and you say, well, I saw Krishna blue, therefore he must be blue. And Baba says, no, you saw what you believed. Very interesting that there are two completely different kinds of visions. That on the one hand, there are visions that Baba enables us to see as a gift. I'm talking about that kind of sakshatkar visions. And he will show you the soul, he will show you Lakshmi Narayan, he will show you Krishna, he will show you golden age, he will show you destruction. He will show you scenes that are not happened yet, but will happen, which we had seen 5,000 years ago, as well as we had seen those visions. And then there's visions which you get in bhakti on the base of faith. Sometimes we complain to Baba that, Baba, why do you give people visions on the base of their faith so that they become convinced that what is incorrect is correct? And it is that if he didn't, that would be a big problem for them. So truth is not about facts. Sometimes people say, well, I don't think, you know, the cycle is 5,000 years identically repeating cycle. They look at it as if it's a fact, and then they say, we can't handle that fact. You see? So you can't really consider truth as being cold, hard facts. And Daddy Jenki also alluded to this when the question was asked about, if you see something bad, what do you do? And she said, well, why should I say I saw this bad thing? I will say, no, I was meditating, I didn't see it. You know? That would be more true. Why would it be more true? Because it takes into consideration much more subtle other aspects of true. And a way to understand this is to take up this point that Baba had given, very, very powerful point. He said that if you tell the truth in anger, it becomes false. If you tell the truth in an accusatory manner, or in a way that makes you look good and somebody else look bad, it's a very selective piece of truth because of some other agenda. I won't say hidden agenda, because it's not at all hidden. It's highly visible, but you think it's hidden. It's totally obvious. You want to make yourself look good, in comparison make everybody else look bad, and that's called truth. That is not truth. But because of our conditioning and culture and so on, we have developed the distortions in our powers of discernment, and which enables us to have a very, very narrow-minded spectrum about truth. And because it's so narrow, it's false. Because it doesn't take into consideration the whole spectrum, we don't realize how obviously we are false. And what the aim is of our practice is to come out from those illusions. It's not very easy to come out of it because the contrast of dark and light or falsehood and truth is comparable to the contrast of one star in the big black night sky. The little light of one star is so little, and all the big black sky is so big, you know. But yet, if there is one star only in the sky, where do you look? You always look at that star. And so the core of our being, we know this from Baba, that the core of our being is fundamentally true. Because that's the definition of the soul. When the soul is aware of itself while in the body, you know, totally soul conscious, which is a very, very high stage, then all the falsehood is visible. Not the falsehood out there, but the falsehood in here. Because we are not concerned with the falsehood out there. If I see something false out there, my eye is directed to the outside, and consequently my vision of the inside is closed. And right there, that's false. Right there. Because perception, in spiritual practice, perception has to be headed towards the inside. So I'll give you an example. You may say, someone, when I'm in contact with that person, makes me upset, angry, sad, whatever the negative emotion is. You probably have someone in your life who does this to you, or who presses your buttons, or who irritates you beyond measure just by their existence. You know, you probably wouldn't admit it, but there need to be people like that just in order for you to practice this particular thing. And the importance of having others in your life who do this to you is that it shows up the fact that you're oriented externally and you are closed to the fact, truth, that there is something in you which is false, and because of which that thing, that person, that situation repeatedly irritates you or makes you feel holier than thou or whatever the thing is. You know, it provokes false ego. And truth on the inside is I have to be able to look at that experience that I'm having, which gives me the impression that the cause of it is external, some person, some situation, some set of circumstances, and to understand, not by deductive logic, because by deductive logic, I would think that that person is causing me trouble. That's the extrapolation. But to understand that there is some ego in me. Ego means false ego. So the whole thing about truth that I think was coming through the Bog message today and was coming through in Daddy Jenki's class is that I cannot be true as long as there is false ego, and my quest for truth is the elimination of false ego, and when I am really true, then I can see God. Also, when I am really true, then I will love. When I'm not true, I will not love. When I'm not true, I am exclusively selfish. Because what is this untruth? This untruth which manifests itself as something or a someone or some situation displeases me. And I pronounce that thing to be bad because it displeases me. This is false ego. It's not to my taste. It doesn't fit with my particular set of principles that I have come up with, you know. All the way along this journey of 63 births of body consciousness, you see, that then now Baba is saying to us, I am the truth, and you can't see me. There is nothing more subtle than Shiv Baba. So how do you begin to arrive at truth when you have just this, this enormous black night with this one little star in it, the star of hope, the star of Shiv Baba, the star of I think I'm a soul, but I don't know what that really means. But it sounds good. I don't think I'm a body, but all of my behavior belies that statement, you know. And I don't discern that it belies that statement. You see, it's not very easy to detect the falsehood in the self. And so in order to help us, Baba has told us a few affirmations, you can say. Like, for example, he has said that the knowledge of the drama is that everything is good. Everything is good. It's good that there's the golden age, it's good that there's the silver age, it's good that there's the copper age, it's good that there's the iron age, it's good that there's destruction, it's good that we go home, it's good that we come back again, it's good that we are, you know, the knowledgeable ones, and it's also good that there's many who are not knowledgeable, and all the various behaviors of all the different people who are in our immediate vicinity is all good. That's the knowledge of the drama. And not only that, but it's always like that. So don't even think about changing any of it. One of the reasons why we're so interested in changing other people is because we think that we can improve them. You know. Because we've been so steeped in this idea that this is good, this is bad, this one's good, this one's bad. And Baba comes along and says, excuse me, let's have a change of perception here, let's have a change of criteria for making judgments. And so we say, well, you are God, so okay. But still our intellect, our power of discernment and judgment is highly polluted with misconceptions and extrapolations. You know, this word extrapolation, I know it's a difficult word, but it's a very, very a useful word because it helps us to understand how we developed irrational thinking, morally irrational thinking. And so when Baba says to us, hey guys, everything is good. Even the fact that you're in pain right now, this is also good. Or even the fact that you're having a bit of Maya right now, this is also good. Or whatever the thing is that you would say, well, this is definitely bad. The thing is, he tells us this so that we can learn inside our own head, inside our own heart, how to relate to that experience or that observation in such a way that we do indeed understand what is good about it. Because when we look at these things superficially, we look at them at face value, we look at them as they appear through our sense perceptions, then we evaluate them actually in materialistic terms. And also, we do not bear in mind that Baba has told us to look at everything in terms of its past, present, and future. I see. So when we are looking at something as a sense perception, then we take it the way it appears, even though we know, because we've been told hundreds of times, that appearances are not reality. But yet, because we are so dedicated to materialism, in spite of all of our wish and assumption that we are spiritual, we still have a sanskar, an immediate reaction to things, that whatever it appears to be, that's what it is. And so Baba has also told us this very good affirmation, along with whatever is in drama is good, whatever appears to be there, it isn't what it presents itself as. It's something else. Then Baba has said, everything that appears to be a bad situation contains, you know, like every cloud has a silver lining, it contains something profitable. And he's teaching us through the classes as well as through circumstances and people around us. As Dadi Jenki was saying, we do not learn by going to universities, we learn by an apprenticeship of being near to Baba. You know? And so when you're near to Baba, Brahma Baba, Shiv Baba, when you're near to a soul who is at a very high level, you will find that they cause you to experience the falsehood in the form of some or another difficulty or pain. And this thing makes you avoid that source, you see. Because falsehood doesn't want to go away. And people who have followed Baba Srimat and followed the Gyan and done everything whatever Baba has said all the way from the beginning until now, it isn't possible for them to be where they are now unless they had done that. And we experience that there are struggles all the time, struggles between what's false and what's true. So I think it's important for us to be willing to engage in struggle. Because if we're not willing to be engaged in struggle, then we will find a way to avoid dealing with the falsehood and find a way to justify the easy way and make it seem to ourselves like I'm following the truth, so because I don't want to do any struggling, because I don't want to deal with it. You see, and this is where the self-deception comes in. We say, this person, situation, set of circumstances displeases me, therefore it is bad. So there's no struggle in that. We just, this is bad and I am good. And God probably agrees with me. Whereas if we say to ourselves, this thing which displeases me, who am I to get displeased by something which we know is good? If I'm getting displeased by something good, it means there's something in my eye and I can't see it. And so we have to struggle with the self and say, okay, self, here you are with your sanskara of displeasure about something, you know, arrogance, some criticism that we have, you see. And so whatever I find myself displeased with, it's quite useful if I say to myself, hey, self, that's ego. So then you say, well, okay, fair enough, that's ego, but still it's not good enough. I need to be able to see exactly what is this ego, because otherwise I'm not seeing the truth, and I can be still deceiving myself, saying, okay, so I have ego, so what? You know, it's still a justification that my ego is okay, and I'm not going to put in the struggle to discern what exactly this thing is. Because making a struggle is time-consuming, is hard, etc. So we say, I don't have time for this. But again and again, it's very valuable for us to say, okay, why am I existing? Why do I exist? Why am I sitting in Madhuban? Why am I sitting in BK? Why am I sitting in Gyan? Why am I sitting in meditation? And the answer always is because I'm trying to reach the truth. I'm trying to really understand what is the truth about me and arrive at it with such clarity that I am not in self-deception. Take, for example, Sri Baba says to all of us, and we all accepted it, that you are formerly gods and goddesses of India. Right? And we all say, definitely. That's a very, very unusual thing to think about oneself. You know, whether you are in a body that's from India or from somewhere else, you know, because this is Gyan, that you are a soul who in another time was a living deity in Bharat in the Golden Age. And now, here you are as this. And you say, well, what is exactly this? What have I become? What exactly is the falsehood that entered into my mind, my intellect, and my sanskaras? Because there's three areas of falsehood came in, you see. For example, when the mind is true, it's stable. When our mind is unstable, what makes it unstable? It has to be falsehood. In what form of falsehood? What makes our mind unstable? We know, we've heard it 100 times. Something you see or something you hear. You know, these are sense perceptions. And we know from the knowledge of the drama that any sense perception we have is equivalent to a TV show. Isn't it? Because there's a drama going on, that's a TV show. And, you know that the medium of television or film is extremely powerful because it engages all of your senses and your mind, and they can make you feel whatever they want to make you feel. You have a happy scene, you feel happy. You have a tragic feel, you feel tragic. You have a tension scene, you feel tension. You have a violent scene, you get all full of, you know, palpitations and fear, and all of these emotions are prompted by sound and image. Whether it's on TV or on the cinema or in real life, I really don't see what's the difference. it's 3D here, but otherwise, you know, it is a very good practice to see that everything that's going on is, in a sense, calculated to press your buttons. You know what I mean by that? So that you are triggered into responding or reacting to some false thing as if it were a true thing. And the whole deal in Gyan is to discern that thing and to have so much sense of self that we do not get deceived by sense perceptions. And though this is easy Raj Yoga, I find that this is not so easy, because our whole experience of reality is very much this, you know, what we see and what we hear, and how it affects us, and how it distorts our ability to see the truth. So, for example, we see someone's behavior, and we immediately forget that this is an actor acting as a villain. And we think this person is really bad. And then, as Daddy Janki was saying, we get that drishti on that person, and we say, you know, we condemn them. And we say, that is a villain. We don't say, this is a beautiful soul, beautiful actor, doing a wonderful role of making a big drama in front of me so that I will be convinced that this is actually a villain, but I know better. This is a soul under an influence. So we have to train ourselves to see that again, again, again. Here is a soul under another influence. And the reason why this scene is coming in front of me is purely and simply to find out whether I get the picture or whether I don't get the picture. Not for any other reason is that scene there. And so this is why the eye has to be focused inside to reach that stage. And that is to ask oneself this question. Can I feel the quality of my love for God? Because I think it's something that we experience very, very occasionally. It's a kind of gift that Baba gives us every so often, especially in the beginning of Gyan, where we get very, very drawn because we feel Baba, we feel Baba's love. And I think a very, very important thing is to feel my love for Baba. And Daddy had also mentioned that when a person isn't clean inside, when a person is still, you know, taking these false things to be real, that's called not being clean inside, or that's also called self-deception, then it isn't possible to feel your love for God, because there'll be a veil between your ability to perceive yourself and that. Because you're perceiving the false, and you can't perceive what is false and God at the same time. So therefore one has to make a choice, and you have to see what is more important. Is it more important for me to be able to experience contact with God, which means both I experience my love for God and I also experience God's love for me? Or do I want to continue with this sanskar of taking material reality to be facts? To be real, see, and that means it's good, it's bad. This one's like this, this one's like that, you know, because that is basically what we call as intellectual arrogance. Intellectual arrogance is that I see something, and it appears to be this, therefore it is this. This is intellectual arrogance. Whereas the golden intellect is, I know that my sense perception is deceptive and it shows me only a small spectrum of the picture. It shows me only the present instant. It doesn't show me the past or the future. And it shows me what's visible and audible, but it doesn't show me all the hidden aspects that are not visible and audible, but which are nevertheless contained in that situation. So if you have half the truth, that's called untruth, isn't it? When somebody is asked to tell the truth and they tell half the truth, that's a lie. They tell that particular bit that is convenient. But to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth is what you're supposed to say in court. That means we're not dealing with just visible and audible things, but we're dealing with, is my inner eye seeing that the scene of the drama is good? That my job is not Dharmaraj, that I respect the soul who is there and see their essential beauty and remember what am I supposed to be doing at any given moment and then tell the truth. Then we go back to Daddy's point that, well, the truth is I didn't see anything, I was meditating. If somebody did something or didn't do something, that was a piece of television, you know, which is nothing to do with me. And then it's possible to go again and again inside and say that the most important of all things is, have I made myself so honorable and honest that I see myself the way God sees me? You know, sometimes it's very useful to remember that childish little thing that people tell you, you know, God is watching your dreams, your thoughts, everything you do secretly and privately. It's actually very good to think that whatever you're doing at any given time, Baba is seeing you as his extremely beloved child and receiving that drishti from Baba, that he's not looking at your behavior, but he's looking at who you are. You see. So when our behavior is under an external influence or a negative influence, however you want to call it, then we are being not ourselves at that moment. Yeah? Say the soul is absolutely pure and beautiful and then something prompts it to get angry. Then that's an external influence and it makes the soul untrue to itself. So will Baba look at that? He's not going to bother to look at that. It's of no interest to him. Within a split second, he will know, okay, child is under another influence. I'm not interested in that. I see child. And so we have to again and again and again see ourselves as that. And what that does, it gradually gives us the power to discern when something is coming along for the explicit purpose of bringing us under another influence and making us go against our real selves. And the trick is, do I see it or don't I? If we don't see it, it means we have eyes that are out of focus. Third eye, out of focus. And so this power of judgment and power of discrimination is exactly this, that I need to make my eye so clear that it doesn't look at what's out there. It looks at what's going on inside when the soul is experiencing something from out there. You see? Otherwise we look at out there and we don't look at how the soul is relating to it. And then the soul operates according to old sanskaras instead of according to yoga, according to jnana, according to accurate discernment and discrimination. You see? So truth is always, look at me and observe very, very minutely where I become false. Many, many people become false because of fear. This is the big thing. So it takes, as you have heard many times, it takes courage to be true. And I think that Baba gives us courage in many, many ways. And there is a saying, a well-known saying, that when the child takes one step of courage, the father gives us 1,000 steps of help. And this is that help that makes it possible for us to be true in spite of our fears. So true is not a person who doesn't have any fear, but a person who has courage in the face of fear, whereas false is cowardice in the face of fear. So it's as if fear is a given. There will be something which will provoke your fear, but will you respond with courage or with cowardice? And cowardice is always, you know, close your eyes and pretend it isn't there. It's very, very false, you know. Courage is open your eyes and stare it down, look at it right in the face, and it will go away. So intellectually we can understand what choice we should make, but then when it comes to the moment, and we will be tested again and again and again and again and again, so that we become good at this. That whenever it comes, let me be with the thing. Let me not close my eyes. Let me not avoid it. Let me face the thing and know it. How it is trying to provoke my cowardice, and let me put courage in the place of that. And when I respond, when I choose courage, then the appropriate elements of the soul, of the mind, the intellect, sanskaras, they will become dominant in the consciousness, and my response to that thing, even if it's only just to stand there and stare at it, is a positive and true response. And that means that I'm putting a step forward in the direction of truth. And it can be, in terms of removal of self-deception, it can be that there is something that comes along to show me that I am lying to myself, to stand there and stare at something which proves to me that you are, who are you trying to kid, you know? You are deceiving yourself. The truth of the matter is you are greedy, say, for example. You know, you say, well, I have a right to such and such. That's a very positive statement. I have a right. You know, but what it really means is I want. There's a difference. We have to use our power of discrimination to discern the distinction between actually what our rights are and what our desires are. Because our intellect, the false intellect, is very clever in justification. It will justify a desire by couching it in terms that make it look good. This justification is a very common form of self-deception. Like Daddy was alluding to it this morning when she was saying, you know, I really want to do service, you know. I want to do something great, this is a good thing, you know, I'm offering myself for some good service, you know. And Daddy was saying that, well, they're not really studying the knowledge, but they're looking for name and fame and glory. See? But the truth is, if you are really true, wherever you are, you will do service. You don't have to think that I want to go over there and then I'll do service, or I want to be in this particular in crowd and then I'll do service. That is greed for name and fame and recognition and appreciation and all of that, which means that the truth is, hey soul, you're empty. And you're trying to fill that emptiness with some external thing, and you're justifying that by saying, oh, this is godly service. You see? You're putting the name of a good thing onto a bad thing. And that's called self-deception. See, whereas if you face the fact and say, hey soul, guess what? I'm greedy. I'm insecure. I think that I'm such and such, the greatest thing since sliced bread, and everybody should recognize it. You know? And but the truth is, the awful truth is, I haven't been meditating. My yoga is down, and I'm feeling the need for something to boost me up. You see? So if I am a coward, I will put that thought aside and think that nobody's giving me a chance, this and that. That's false. False ego talking. And the truth is, I've been lazy, I've been negligent, I haven't maintained my disciplines, and I have slid backwards. And so guess what? Better get back into my disciplines and get myself moving forward on my correct spiritual track and bring myself to a point where my stage is going to do the service, and I am not concerned with the results or how I am looked at. You see, I'm concerned that I do pure action because I have a chance. Let's have traffic control. Will be with us in a few minutes, but until that time, I have a couple more points I would like to share with you. One of the things that I find is a good strategy with the self is to put myself alone in between God and death, because it is actually the truth that we are alone. And we are in constant company with one another. And as Daddy was saying yesterday, there was a time when she became overwhelmed with the feeling of love for the whole family, you know, because it's a very beautiful context that we live in, of the cream of all the souls in the world. You know. But at the same time, in front of God and in front of death, in front of the consequences of my karma, I am alone. And Daddy had also warned us that do not mess in somebody else's karma. You know. Baba knows, Shiv Baba knows, Brahma Baba knows the karmic accounts of the soul. None of us do, you know. And a very, very good piece of advice is do not interfere with somebody's karma. This is one of the reasons why it is often said, you know, stay away from spiritual healers. Because it's essentially a temporary interference with someone's karma. That's all. But I have to face the consequences of my own karma. And I think that is also a very important truth. And nobody else is going to face the consequences of my karma. Only me. And whenever I have to face a consequence of my karma, it's very easy to become false and say, it's this one's fault, that one's fault, etc. They made me angry, or whatever. But the truth is, regardless of the provocations, I am my own sanskaras, I have to face the consequences of my own karma, and I have to face my own death. And I have to be, you know, there is an expression, you know, you come in front of God naked and alone. Naked in the sense that no status symbols, no position, no any of that stuff which we use to bolster up our false ego and say, I am whatever. The truth is, I am essentially naked and alone in front of God, the truth. And the question is my head held high? Because whenever a person is faced with the truth, if they are not true, their eyes go down, the head goes down. Shame makes that happen. Because when there is shame in the soul, because I went against my own principles, I went against truth, then we cannot look at God, or we cannot look at evil straight in the eyes, because we have shame. And that means that we are false. There's a poem, I think it's Keats' English poem, where it says, truth is beauty. Beauty is truth, and that's all you need to know. And in Hindi bhakti chants, there is one very famous one, Satyam Shivam Sundaram. You must have heard that. And it means that God is the truth, Shiva, the beautiful. And I think that beauty, the sort of aesthetic end of truth, is an interesting one to explore. When we look at the soul, and you know the Murali today was very deeply about the soul, we know that the subtle organs through which the soul functions are the mind, the intellect, and the sanskaras. And that I very often speak of the intellect as the moral conscience, because the word buddhi, if you translate it into English as intellect, the word intellect doesn't provide us with the same kind of associations as you get with the word buddhi. But in Hindi there's also another word which is vivek, which also means conscience. And in India you know how much the consciousness is divided into many, many different sections, not just mind, intellect and sanskaras. And when we're wanting to go deep into truth, it's we're naturally going to go into ourselves and observe ourselves from the inside and see what part of me is it that understands the difference. And this is also an expression that refers to Gyan itself. It is said that Gyan means to know the difference. To know the difference between a concept that is true and a concept that is not true. You know also that one point in today's Murali where Baba had said that whatever people say, whatever the gurus say, the people respond to it saying, Satvachan Maharaj, whatever you're saying is true. But they don't think first and check whether or not it's true. There is a very deep part of everyone that is used to the idea that a person of authority speaks the truth. We expect people in authority and of authority to be telling the truth. And previously, I don't think it is so now, but previously, if you wanted to get a passport or something, you'd have to get a signature of a professional, like a doctor or a lawyer or the headmaster or mistress of a school, because they were automatically assumed to be truthful. And that they would say truthfully, yeah, this is the person. Now, this is not done. Because that assumption that a person in authority will always tell the truth has been questioned and found wanting in too many instances, so it cannot be a foregone conclusion anymore. But yet, it is very much there inside people to assume that whoever is in authority is telling the truth. And so God, the greatest authority, who is the truth himself, says, as Daddy was mentioning day before yesterday, I am the creator. I know what I'm talking about. And he has that intoxication. Very lovely to observe or come to know Baba more and more through his words. Because you can really know Baba through the Murli. When he says, I am me, I am the creator, I know what I'm talking about, I am the truth. So, distinguish it. Judge for yourself is an expression that even comes in the Murli, even in English. Sometimes Baba speaks in English, though he doesn't speak in French. I was thinking, if Baba would speak in French, how the Gyan would be, what references he would have to make. Le Petit Prince, probably, you know. You know that story, The Little Prince? A very nice story. Anyway, the truth is discerned by our conscience, by our moral conscience, by our intellect. The intellect can understand whether something is factually correct, like 2 plus 2 is 4, so it has that calculating capability. And Baba will speak to us in that aspect when he's explaining to us how it is not possible for God to be Krishna or to be omnipresent or to provide both happiness and sorrow, because it is logically inconsistent. It doesn't compute, you can say. But when the intellect is tamopradan, then it cannot tell whether something computes or doesn't compute in that aspect of logic. And so part of the purification of the intellect is that it is able to discern whether a statement stands or not, whether it's tenable. And then Baba also says that not only is the idea of God being omnipresent logically untenable, inconsistent, and you can't even think about it, but it's also an insult. So our intellect, our moral conscience, is able to discern whether or not something that is said about God or about a soul is an insult. Now, when we are in body consciousness, if somebody says something to you which you take to be an insult, that's the false ego reacting. And Baba has told us, in regard to truth, your shan, your honor. Your honor is to stay in your stage of self-respect. So, if we come off of that seat of self-respect and we go on to some other seat, some other position, I am such and such, or I am so and so, and then if that is questioned or thrown in a bad light, then we feel insulted. is because we, in the first place, were on a false position, on a false seat. Because if I am in my seat of self-respect, then we have one very powerful thing working for us, and that is that we know very deeply, very strongly, very powerful, that the truth is self-evident. The truth about me is self-evident. You know, even if the whole planet says you are such and such, so on and so forth, and everybody looks at you like that, they can only continue to do that as long as you yourself take it on board and adopt that untruth and get in a fluster about it, saying, this is untrue. You know, it is untrue. You adopt it, make yourself untrue, so then you make whatever they say true. And then you can't figure out why they still think it's true. You see how it works? It's very, very subtle. But if we stay in our stage of self-respect, no matter what is said, slanderous, libelous, whatever it might be, no matter what is said, it cannot stick because you don't take it on board. Sometimes, many, many times, people say, why does Daddy Janki give me drishti, give me toli without drishti? Many, many people say that. Have you experienced that? And a lot of people say, oh, Daddy should respect me, love me, give me toli, drishti along with the toli, because I'm not interested in the toli, I want the drishti. I'm coming for the toli, not because I need toli, because I need drishti. And she doesn't give it, she'll look at somebody else, you know. And I've been observing this very closely. And also observing myself, you see, because you can make presumptions about other people, but look at yourself. How do I feel on all of the many, many different occasions? Because we get tons and tons of toli, with or without drishti, from Daddy. Yes? And so there are many, many opportunities to see, how do I feel in the circumstance? And it's very, very intriguing. I found it very intriguing. So I've been observing this in myself and in other people for a long, long time to see, now, what is going on here? You know, because we know very well, Daddy could very easily give toli with drishti. So, obviously, there's something going on. He's specifically giving drishti to certain people. Like, for example, she looks the other way when she gives toli to me, but she gives nice, good drishti to the next guy. And I say, well, what about me? I missed out, you know. Especially if we're in a sort of 500-person long line, you know. And we expect, you know, 500 perfect sakash, you know, for each one. Expectations, you know. And we know the word expectation indeed is a red flag. Are my expectations not being met? Is it a situation where I feel slighted? You see? All this is ego. Now, if I love Daddy, who's very lovable, as a matter of fact, I will not feel one way or the other. But if I am having a little drop even of ego, especially hidden ego, then I will feel insulted. Nobody said I was omnipresent or I was a donkey or anything like that. They just simply didn't look at me when I thought they should. In other words, It is revealing to the self that am I after respect, regard, you know, all the things? Is my dignity being properly respected? And if I am more worried about that than, as a matter of fact, and also not only that, but it hurts, doesn't it? It hurts, and then we say, ooh, daddy gave us sorrow. Or did we take sorrow? Is it possible to take tolly with sorrow? It has to be possible because a lot of people do it. So now the question arises, is that true? I mean, is it true consciousness? Is it true love? Is it true interaction? You see? And I find it extremely interesting because I was observing this very, very closely to see. Now, when we get hurt by something that isn't actually an assault or any of those sort of illegal practices like beating and killing and all of these things, we get hurt from something. We take sorrow from a look or not a look, you know. And Baba is saying, do not take sorrow. We know all about do not give sorrow, though we may be still doing that, but most of the time, the sort of untruth that lurks within the soul is made known to us at the moment when we take sorrow. Have you thought of that? We take sorrow. You might notice at the end of the day when you do your chart or look at your day and see, you know, how many times did I take sorrow? What were the circumstances of me taking sorrow? Why exactly did I take sorrow? And we're taking this simple example because I'm sure everybody must have had tolly from daddy today, yes? And maybe you can put a show of hands. Who got drishti satisfactorily? That's a minority. You see? So there must be a lot of, you know, as they say, what do they say? A reason in the madness or something? A method in the madness? Yeah. It must be showing on because daddy is very, very tricky, as you know. And you know that one of the things that is said about daddy, Janki, is that like Ganesh has every Indian deity has a vehicle, and Ganesh's vehicle is a mouse or a rat. In Hindi, there's no differentiation between a mouse and a rat. It's chua, either way. And mostly it's a rat. So a rat anesthetizes its victim and then sticks the teeth in and draws some blood. That's how it operates. And so it is said very, very often that Dadi will do her work very, very, very subtly in such a way that you don't get hurt. For example, if Dadi would say what's there in each of us in terms of our ego, that would probably hurt a whole lot more than looking the other way when giving drishti. What do you think? I think it would. Sometimes it comes in the murli when Baba says, if you wish, you can come and ask Baba that according to current behavior, what status would I get in the golden age? But nobody ever had the courage to do it. Because somewhere in our conscience, in our intellect, on some maybe subconscious level, we know if all the veils would be removed and we would see the naked truth about ourselves, it wouldn't be quite what we would like to be displayed. And the part of this topic is the thing about self-deception. So when I feel hurt, when I didn't get drishti along with tolly, this hurt We can say it's an insult, or we can go a little deeper and say, what is it in there that was stung? And it has to be the ego. Because I don't see that there's anything else that could get stung like that. It has to be the ego. And our contract with Daddy, aside from our contract with Baba, and part of our contract with Baba is to enter into the contract with Daddy, which is a kind of medical contract. We want to have some surgery and have our ego removed. Our false ego is unnecessary, like an appendix. And they never, you know, take out the appendix until it's grumbling or it, it erupts in some way. So I think that Daddy's strategy for us, among many other strategies, but this is a strategy to stick the needle in the ego so that we can feel it, because otherwise the ego is absolutely indistinguishable to a self. Because if it were distinguishable, we would have got rid of it long ago. When you do very, very deep work on yourself with this constant aim, I want to find the truth and I want to become completely true. One analogy for it is, of course, gold. 24 karat gold. That's the purest gold you can get. And one of the ways in which they test for gold is to put, I think it's sulfuric acid on the metal. And if it has a reaction, then there's some base metal in it. And I think that this non-receiving of drishti, which is actually totally random, you know, as a matter of fact, if we take it personally, that is also ego. So it's very important for us to understand that it is actually random. And that if that lack of drishti is like a splash of sulfuric acid that fizzes on the base metal of our yet still alive ego problem, then we will know that it's there. Because if it doesn't fizz, we won't know it's there, isn't it? So our contract is, say, Daddy, do the job. Make my ego fizz so that I can know whether it's there and where it is, you see. Because our topic in regard to truth is also about cleanliness. And any impurity in the gold is also considered not clean. And when you put chemical on it and it turns green or whatever, the copper or the silver or the iron that's been mixed into it, it will show when that chemical is put on and then in this reaction. So this reaction that we have indicates still I am not yet true. So what do we do? So I've been thinking about this in my microscope, how to get this thing out. Of course, Baba says, best way is the fire of yoga. And Baba had given us this work last year to meditate minimum 3.5 hours a day, 108 hours a month. And I found that when we were actually doing that, you could really feel that there was progress going on. At least you weren't slipping back. At least you weren't just marking time. You were actually moving forward. Did you experience that? And then the question arises, how to keep it up? Because when there's nothing else going on and you make yourself have a very, you know, basic routine, BK routine, then you can do it. And then all this other stuff gets in the way, like you have to do service, you do your job, all these things cut into that time of yoga, or you have to go on lots of airplanes and it wrecks your biorhythms and so on. And then you find that you slip back and your yoga level goes down. And along with that, all the ego comes up and then you become more reactive. When the yoga level is up to scratch and these things happen, non-drishti when toli comes, or not being noticed, or not being given whatever regard you decide you have to have, you feel, you know, stung, because the untruth creeps back. And we find that our work of yoga was incomplete. And so we didn't get cooked, we got half cooked. So it didn't succeed. And then whatever we were trying to accomplish and reinstates itself. And so the work that one does when it isn't kept up is in a sense lost, you see, because you slip back, and then somehow or the other something has to get us to stoke up the fires again so that we do get back. This is why it takes so long. And the ego, you know, you can spray it as much as you want with yoga and it'll almost die, almost die, almost die, and then you'll quit spraying and it'll come back up again. Like the certain places, they have brush fires. I remember one time in California, there was a huge fire where hundreds of houses were destroyed. A whole mountain caught fire. Why did it catch fire? Because there was a little fire and they put it out, but not completely. And the wind came up and it took out huge areas. And so in a way, our yoga, the continuation, maintenance of our yoga has to be kept up in order that the work that we're doing actually reaches a conclusion, and that all of the work doesn't get undermined by the fact that we took the cake out of the oven too soon. We didn't leave it in there baking long enough. So I think that a very important aspect of really bringing ourselves to that state of truth is to bear in mind that the disciplines that we have to do, the very, very basic disciplines, must be kept up at any cost. And when, you know, we get, say, tired or distracted or disheartened or whatever that is, this is Maya, which is also another word for untruth, coming along to wreck our process of reaching truth. So to become truthful, we have to always be very, very attentive that the fire is kept stoked up. I think one of the important reasons why we come again, again, again to Madhuban is because it's a very, very intense vibration of the polarities of truth and untruth. We need to be in that world of polarities so that the thing we're working with is really brought into focus. When we're in Madhuban, we meet Baba, we meet Daddies, we have Toli with or without Drishti, we have presence, we have Brahma Bhojan. Anyway, we have all those things, but especially, you know, we have special meditation, we have special classes, we have all sorts of things, and it tunes us up. And also, our insufficiencies or our defects are also brought into sharp focus, and you get to really have a good dose of Maya from time to time, yes? Nobody's saying yes, but I know that it happens like that. And it's very essential to understand that we are in this place which pushes us into this polarity. You really find yourself experiencing very great things, understanding things in a very special way, and then the opposite is also there. It helps us to know where we are, because somehow so easily everything kind of blurs. When we're in the, you can say, we always say the real world, although this is probably a lot more real, but anyway, the real world, which is the false world, the world of Maya, the world of the Iron Age, is definitely its accurate description as the false world, but we always call it the real world. So even our vocabulary is kind of off track. But anyway, never mind. We go out there and you're not in an environment where the good and evil is in a polarized condition, but everything is all kind of gray. You know? It's overall general sort of acceptable body consciousness with the occasional bit of unacceptable body consciousness. And so the stark contrast between the truth and the untruth gets lost, and our intellect operates, as you notice from Baba's teachings, the divine intellect operates on the basis of contrast. This knowledge is taught to us in a certain context and with contrasts. You know soul consciousness in contrast to body consciousness. You know virtues in contrast to vices. And then Baba also says that you exist in a dimension of comparisons and contrasts, whereas Baba doesn't. Baba exists in the absolute. Baba is the absolute truth. And so he gets us to remember him. Remember him means that we orient our attention. Our intellect also is called our attention. We focus our attention on the one who is the absolute truth. But we can't do that. Although we do it, but we can't do it. Because you can't actually properly focus attention on Shri Baba unless you're clean. You can sort of go in that general direction, and that's good. But to actually focus on Baba, laser beam, is also a cleansing process. So on the one hand, you can't do it because you're not clean. On the other hand, you have to do it, otherwise you can't get clean. So this is also working. So in Madhavan, in the place where this sort of good and evil is in stark polarity, we have moments when we really see the truth, don't you? Just a glimpse of I, the soul, being in this body and seeing the truth, and then it kind of fades. But you have a glimpse of it, and in that glimpse you can also make a connection, a real proper connection with Baba, and get burned in a nice way. You know, the fire of yoga means the soul gets burned in the sense that the sort of stark, clear truth burns itself into your consciousness, and you feel that, yeah, you can see it. And then you have to remember what you saw, because you can't see it all the time. So those moments of seeing it are really beautiful gifts, And what we're supposed to do is not get upset that it's not there all the time, but to remember what we saw and make the effort to bring our focus of attention to that which we had seen, because we know in the intellect that that was true. Yes? We know it's true because our intellect has the ability to detect truth when it sees it. And even though we get deceived very often, we have self-deception, we get deceived by situations and by others and so on because of the ego. And so there is a thing called the body conscious intellect, and then there's also a thing called the soul conscious intellect. So the body conscious intellect is very intellectual. That means it knows how to justify, it knows how to explain that black is white and white is black and be very convincing and all of those things. So yes, we know how to do that. And the body consciousness or the ego, which is polluted, will accept black as white and white as black and all of that, false as true, two as three, like this. But the soul conscious intellect will say, wait a minute, what is this? And it will bring it into the equation, points which were mentioned earlier, like truth told with criticism, anger. So if I say such and such is the truth, I saw it, and you say that with criticism, that truth is an illusion. It's not really truth. Is the body conscious intellect, the ego, saying, I am holier than thou? Isn't it? Criticism. And so when we experience that hurt from not receiving drishti when we think we're supposed to get it, along with the toli, the blessings, the gifts, the all of the things, it's because there's still that thing that says, I have the right to judge you by my standards. You see, and this was one of Dadi's very strong points that she was saying in the class, that we don't. Because our standards are yet still questionable. And what is this? This is a saying in India, if the pot hits the wall or the wall hits the pot, either way, the pot breaks. So if you, with the ego, say, I am right, you remember that point in Baba's Avyakt Murli of last season, this word, I am right, is also a red flag, and it means ego. I am right. This person in position, whatever, is not right. I am right. And it is actually an expression of falsehood, going by the vocabulary of I am right. So actually Baba has given us many, many, many little things to help us to detect the undetectable. Selfish. What I want goes, and everybody else's, doesn't matter. And Dadi was talking, I think it was today, about the importance of being cooperative. Be a cooperative soul in Baba's task. Because none of us know very much about what's going on, no matter how many service newsletters you read or how many people you talk to about what is exactly happening. You know just a teeny tiny bit. And now that the BK organization has become so large, it's virtually impossible to know everything. And so one of the things that many of us have been discussing with each other is the value of understanding what is your part and what part you're supposed to be dealing with and knowing about, but also knowing that it's just a tiny little fragment of the whole. And so when you just know a tiny little fragment of the whole, and you know that the only one who knows the whole thing is actually Baba, you know, not even, we could say, any region in charge or zone in charge or Dadi would know everything what's going on. There's too much, you know. Even whatever, maybe any problems, how do you know what all the problems are? You don't know what, anyway, they're not interesting. Baba knows. And Baba had said he can turn on his TV and look at any center or anyone anytime he wants in a second. Sometimes we experience a little spark coming. Maybe that's his TV turning on. Have you experienced that? You know, you may be doing something quite ordinary, a spark comes on. Oops! He saw me being ordinary. And that was my picture in his picture bank for the day. You know? Could be. So then another part of the effort is to try to keep myself being true, being real for as much time of the day as possible. And I think that effort also helps us to notice that we can actually take the time to put in the period of meditation that's necessary to keep up the yoga so that the cake continues to bake, the oven doesn't get cool, and we do ultimately reach our real, true, cooked condition, where the gold has had all of the impurities removed by the heat, by the chemicals of different actions to which we may react. And also we have to be, and another aspect of truth is we have to be very, very flexible, especially in the big gathering. Flexibility is a great value. If it's hot, if it's cold, if you're on, if you're off, if you're in, if you're out. You know, if you're spoken to this way or spoken to that way or looked at or not looked at, you know. It's a kind of continuing series of circumstances for which you have to bend. Like grass, you know. Grass doesn't break, glass does. So we have to change the L into an R there. If we're too touchy, if we're too fragile, if we're like glass, any little thing can break us. So that breakability is also an aspect of untruth. Because if we're rigid, along with being very fragile, that's not going to work. We're reacting to everything, you see. Whereas if we're really like gold, really pure, and we have allowed ourselves to be heated to the maximum point, you know, boiled gold. And also gold, you know, gold leaf, it gets beaten. You have to be able to be beaten. Even Baba was saying in the last Murli, especially for the Kumaris, you know, can you take all the blows that will come to you? Because if you want to be gold, the heat is necessary and the beating on the gold is necessary. And a gold leaf is so soft, and it wraps itself around anything it touches. Is that much flexible. And I think that also, that analogy of being able to flex with anything and be completely pliable doesn't mean that you are doormats and let people walk over you. That's a different thing altogether. Because when that happens, then there's a lot of resentment. So that's that's also ego, resentment. It's totally ego. But when you are very, very flexible, but still the stage of self-respect, then you will never take something as an insult, but you will love. That means you will give. If we're in expectation, we want something, we need this, we expect that, that's a taker. This is not a deity. A deity is a devta, a taker is a levta. There's a difference in that. So a taker is still somebody with ego, somebody who's incomplete, somebody who needs something to bolster up their sense of self. Whereas when you're really in the stage of self-respect, like Baba had said in the first Murli of the season, that the stage of self-respect for this season is jewel of contentment. When we are content in any and every situation, and this is the true stage. Okay, Om Shanti.